Again, everyone, just for the record, Judge Sparks is joining us by telephone. So the next case is United States v. Wideis. Captain Kiss, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant?
Yes, Your Honor.
Captain Hopkins, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please proceed.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Captain Andor Kiss, and along with my co-counsel, Major Rachel Gordienko, I represent the appellant, Specialist Michael Wideis. Chief Judge Olson, may I reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal?
Granted.
For nearly as long as we've had the common law, our society has recognized the dangers that come with convicting a person based on their words alone. Traditionally, this doctrine of corpus delicti was intended to prevent convictions of wholly fictitious crimes, crimes that didn't happen at all. But in recent decades, the Supreme Court has identified additional compelling justifications for the corroborative rule. Those include an understanding that some people, after giving coerced confessions, might not have the evidence or the explanation necessary to satisfy the Fifth Amendment rule. Still more, as the Supreme Court said in Smith, they may lack trustworthiness when extracted from one who was under the pressure of a police investigation and whose words may reflect the strain and confusion attending his predicament rather than a clear reflection of his past. In light of these justifications, the Supreme Court has identified that this is a very important rule. It acknowledges that it invades on the province of the fact finder, but still holds that that invasion is necessary because the average juror lacks an understanding of our system's troubling history with false and coerced confessions. And quite frankly, the average juror just doesn't believe that in the same position, they would confess to something they didn't do.
Captain Kiss, I wonder whether the very beginning of your argument raises a question, though. You were talking about the common law. And indeed, in your brief, you go through the two prongs, the corpus delicti, Supreme Court rulings, and so forth. But to what extent has MRE 304 completely changed the landscape? Now we're not dealing with common law. We're dealing with the language of 304. And 304 tells us that the real issue here is trustworthiness.
Yes, Your Honor. What I'd say to that is when we're determining what the rule means by the word trustworthiness, we still need to look for some explanation. It's a somewhat ambiguous term. What is sufficiently trustworthy? We look elsewhere in the rule and it talks about independent evidence sufficient to create an inference of the truth. That itself requires some further elaboration in order to understand what it is that we're applying here. And beyond that, when we look at the military rules of evidence in Section 3, it's a little bit different. Because Article 36 tells us that the President, when promulgating these rules, wants them or is advised that to the extent practicable, they should mirror what's applied in federal court. And since there's no analog in federal court, the drafters here tell us, look to the federal courts. We're giving you a synthesis of what is in the constitutional or what the constitutional precedent says from the Supreme Court. And then, that's basically a synthesis, but when we have to interpret the actual words in here, the federal case law is the best place to look. And so when we look to the federal case law, there is justification and good reason for applying the two-pronged analysis that we argue for. So in order to really address those underlying justifications that I spoke about a moment ago, you need both prongs. The first prong of our test, which is based in the Supreme Court's holding in Smith, the injury and harm, criminality, and an association with the accused in some cases, is looking at that traditional corpus delicti in purpose, making sure that someone isn't convicted of a crime if that crime never happened, if we don't have proof that a crime actually occurred. When we look at the second prong here, which is based in Opper, and it's talking about whether there's sufficient evidence to create an inference of truth, we're looking to make sure that we have the right person. But in addition to that, we're focusing back on the Supreme Court's language about how these statements are sometimes unreliable because a person is willing to say whatever it might take to get out of an uncomfortable interrogation as opposed to having a calm and reflected look back on the truth of their history. And so that two-pronged test here is necessary. And one other thing that I would like to bring to the Court's attention before digging into this a little deeper is the degree of scrutiny which should be applied here. So in both Smith and Calderon, the Supreme Court identified that when there are indicia of unreliability surrounding the making of a confession or an admission, that the corroborative requirement needs to be higher. In Calderon, they say that there needs to be great care taken to make sure there's sufficient corroboration. And in Smith, they talk about careful scrutiny needing to be applied. And that's no doubt a reflection of the fact that when we're determining trustworthiness as the rule requires, the circumstances surrounding the making of a statement are just as important as the content of the statement itself. And so here, because there are indicia of unreliability, we need a higher degree of corroboration that might otherwise be required. And that's especially the case when you look at some of the facts surrounding the confession or the admission that my client made. He's not a particularly sophisticated individual. Despite being a military police officer, he waives his rights twice and agrees to a polygraph. Then during the first interrogation, denies any criminal conduct entirely. And the second continues that denial up until the law enforcement agents falsely tell him that there had either been a problem or that he had failed his polygraph and fed him the lines of what he ultimately admitted to. Nonetheless, by the end of the interrogation, he recanted, saying that he had lied and only had said those things because he was afraid. And so given that context, the Supreme Court's precedent tells us that we need a higher degree of corroboration. And so that should be kept in mind when we look at the two prongs of the analysis here.
Counsel, what do we do with the fact that the President, when he amended MRE 304, he used to say, right, you had to have independent evidence that corroborates the essential facts, which I completely agree with you, would support your interpretation of the rule and the way it should be applied. But that language was eliminated and just replaced with evidence that tends to establish the trustworthiness. So how do we have to, if you're going to win, we have to write something, and we'd have to explain away this amendment to the rule. What do we say? Because the exact language that I think you would have pointed to 8 years ago to explain why the two-step process is the right way to go is gone.
Your Honor, I think that when we're looking at the two Supreme Court cases that are on point here, the government, or in the drafter's notes, we point to both of them, both Smith and Opper, and we say that we want to get back in line with federal practice. Smith doesn't say anything about trustworthiness, but it's inherent that in order for something to be trustworthy, it needs to, or for a confession to be trustworthy, it needs to be to a crime that actually happened. I believe the Ninth Circuit discussed this in Lopez-Alvarez, where they said there's basically two types of corroborating evidence. There's evidence that makes it more likely that the crime occurred, and therefore a confession is more trustworthy because we know that at the very least it's not a confession to something that didn't happen. And then we also look to the circumstances to determine both, you know, as we discussed about the circumstances surrounding it and the content and whether that maps onto the crime. And so when assessing trustworthiness, those two things are both actually implicated here. And with respect to the essential facts analysis, as you were discussing, we still look to see what are the essential facts within a confession. And Tankobaya, as the First Circuit discusses this, when it talks about how we don't just want to corroborate ancillary facts or things that aren't really relevant to the actual crime. When we're determining whether a confession is trustworthy, what we really care about, given the immediate case as an example, is not that he had access to a child he lived with or that he regularly changed a child that he cared for. It's whether he committed a particular lewd act. That's still the essential fact. And when we're looking to see whether there's adequate corroboration to determine, or there's adequate trustworthiness, that's what we care about here.
Counsel, can I ask a question about this guidance that we're supposed to look at the federal precedent? And I understand that's not controversial that there is this guidance, but in the federal courts, the corpus delicti rule is not a rule of evidence. It's a substantive criminal law. It's a substantive rule of criminal law. At least that's the way most of the courts look at it. Where we have 304, which is clearly a rule of admissibility. And how do we map those two together? Is there a substantive corpus delicti rule in criminal law in military justice? In other words, in the federal court system, there's no analog in the rules of evidence. And yet the evidence, if it comes in but doesn't establish a crime, then you get to corpus delicti. And that's why commentators in the court say it's a substantive rule of law rather than a rule of evidence. It's pretty clear that we have a rule of evidence. Does that mean we don't have a corpus delicti rule? And if we don't have a corpus delicti rule, how do we, as substantive law, how do we analogize our system to the federal system?
Your Honor, I think this goes back to a point I was making earlier about how Section 3 of the Military Rules of Evidence are just a little different. If this was hearsay or something where there is a federal analog, then I think that, you know, it would be easier to do this analysis. But here, a large portion of military rule of evidence, or the Section 3 of the Military Rules of Evidence, are basically synthesis of constitutional principles that we get from precedent. And so here, especially in light of the drafter's analysis, when they're saying, hey, this rule is intended to align with what they're doing in federal court. In federal court, as you said, Your Honor, is using this not as a rule of evidence, but as, you know, substantive law that comes from our history, essentially. It's a common law right. And so when we're looking at interpreting Military Rule of Evidence 304 Charlie, we should be applying it the same way. Because even though it's written down, at its essence, it's performing the same function.
Well, I suppose I had a little different view, which is, could we simply say that 304 is only about admissibility, but that doesn't mean we don't also have a rule of corpus delicto?
That could also be the case, where 304 is an explicit prohibition on admitting evidence if it doesn't satisfy the rule. But then in addition to that, if we're looking at Smith and Opper and seeing that there's this, you know, common law right that's inherent within kind of our system of justice that dates back to the, you know, 14th, 13th century, that that's something that also would need to be satisfied here in order to admit a confession.
But would that help you in this case, given that the issue, the assigned issue, is only about the admissibility of the evidence?
Your Honor, I think that regardless of whether we're looking at it from the perspective of admissibility under the rule or whether we're applying, you know, the case law and determining whether or not this should be presented to the fact finder, it's ultimately the same. It's whether we're going to be admitting it as an exhibit at trial for the fact finder to see, or whether either by function of the common law or by function of application of the rules of evidence, it's not going to be determined admissible for the purpose of, you know, going to the fact finder instead of being stopped at the preliminary gatekeeper, which in this case is the judge.
Thank you.
Counsel, you've referenced Opper a number of times. Are there any parts of Opper that you would view as inoperable under the rule?
No, Your Honor. I believe that in conjunction with Smith, Opper is exactly what we'd ask this court to apply. And it's very similar to in United States versus Yates under the Court of Military Appeals back in 1989, where they simply applied both. So you have first a look at whether the traditional three-element corpus delicti test was proven. In that case, they were citing to Wong Sun and footnote 15, which references Smith. But then also looking at what the, you know, kind of the core of the Opper holding is, which is whether there's these sufficient guarantees of trustworthiness and an independent evidence sufficient to create an inference of truth.
What about the language in Opper which says, we think the better rule to be the corroborative evidence need not be sufficient independent of the statements to establish corpus delicti?
Yes, Your Honor. And this is one of the difficulties that exists here, is that the term corpus delicti is used in a variety of ways, and it doesn't always mean the same thing. So in analyzing how the court's using it in Opper, what's clear is when they say corpus delicti, they're talking about the whole of the corpus delicti, or this traditional requirement that there needed to be independent corroborating evidence of every element of the crime. And so for Opper, I would agree with the court there that there does not any longer need to be independent evidence of every element as long as we satisfy prong one, which is to show a crime actually occurred in accordance with Smith, and then also that the underlying circumstances surrounding the confession create an inference of truth, which is really the heart of what Opper is requiring.
Would it be helpful to, much as those of us who took Latin like to have it perpetuated, not use a Latin term here, but instead focus specifically on what the federal courts have applied?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And that's something that makes this a lot easier, because some of the confusion that exists between our brief and the government's is that that term is used to mean different things. Just in preparing for oral argument today, I was able to identify at least four uses. One to mean the three-element test, or the corpus delicti test that Wigmore came out with. One to mean the whole of the corpus delicti, or that every element of the underlying charge was. One is just the body of harm, so the body in a murder case or a burned house in an arson case. And then just generally to talk about corroboration as an area of law generally. And so when we're looking at these cases in Opera and in some of the federal courts and even within military precedent, whenever the term corpus delicti is used, it's not immediately clear what exactly the rule is. And so it's more important to look to see how the court is applying the law and what they're considering. And I think that that's something that would relieve a lot of the confusion that exists in this area.
What is the principle that you're offering the court to consider here in lieu of corpus delicti?
Your Honor, I think it would just be to apply the Supreme Court's two tests. So in 1954, they provide two tests for whether or not something is sufficiently corroborated. There's the Smith test, which is whether there's injury or harm, whether there's criminality, and in cases where there is intangible injury and association with the accused. And then the second prong would be to apply Opper, which is just looking at the circumstances and the content of the confession or admission, and then making a determination whether substantial independent evidence is there to render an inference of truth in what's being said.
And where in the government's brief do they disagree with that?
Your Honor, I believe the government's brief is saying that the Smith test, or looking to see whether there's an actual crime committed, isn't required, and that that was what was jettisoned by the Supreme Court in Opper. But in light of Smith and in Wong Sun, that's clearly not the case. That is not only continued to be applied by the Supreme Court, but I think in our reply brief, we also cited to a number of federal circuits which still also continue to apply that three-pronged rule. One fourth thing I'd like to look to is just even in applying the test as the government that the government wants, we don't have enough to satisfy the corroborative requirement here. Because as this court said in Adams, when we're addressing whether there's a sufficient amount of evidence, we look to both the quantity and the quality of evidence. And the quality of evidence here just isn't sufficient. The government is no doubt going to be focusing on the child's change in behavior, but that's something that, when you look at it in context, is a lot less aggravating than it might seem at first glance. The child did have a behavioral change, but that didn't happen around May or June when this crime allegedly occurred. It didn't happen in August when it came to light. It wasn't until after the child was subjected to an incredibly invasive forensic assault examination, where we have testimony she cried and protested throughout the entire thing, was then moved to a different country across multiple time zones with different, you know, without her father figure in her life and is the subject of all the anxiety that's the fallout of this investigation, that she first exhibits different or troubling behavior in September. And so that's something very similar to what this court considered in Fashian when they said, look, the circumstances of the anxiety, the fact that the parents are splitting up, the mother's getting remarried, all of those things are far more likely to be the cause of this troubling behavior than any sort of evidence that is sufficient to show sexual abuse. And so in addition to a misapplication of the rule, the actual evidence that was applied here was insufficient.
Judge Sparks, do you have any questions?
I just wanted to ask, is there any evidence in the record that an expert testified as to what you just stated, that these other factors are in fact more likely to be the cause of the child's change in behavior? Or are you simply drawing on testimony?
Your Honor, there was an expert, and I see that I'm out of time.
Please proceed. Continue.
Your Honor, there was an expert who testified both during a 39A hearing and later in the trial that discussed how the child's behavior was not clearly indicative of sexual abuse. That's, you know.
Right, I understand that, but did he get into what might be the cause of the child's behavioral change?
No, Your Honor, I believe that his testimony was simply that it would be too difficult to ascribe a particular cause. But that when I was referencing this, I was focused on this court's holding in Fashian, where this court described how certain circumstances surrounding family life and the stressors of an investigation may be the cause for the behavior.
But in Fashian, that may have been the case. But here, there is no evidence that it's the case here, is it?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't understand that.
In Fashian, there apparently was some indication that the child's behavior was based upon these other factors. But here, unlike in Fashian, there's no such evidence, is there?
Your Honor, I don't believe that Fashian had evidence presented that would say that the child's behaviors were based on some of the other circumstances in their life. I think that that was something that the court reasoned might be a alternative explanation, such that jumping to a conclusion that the cause of the behavioral change was sexual abuse was insufficient to satisfy the corroborative requirement.
You mean throwing in some dicta there?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm having trouble hearing. What was the question?
You mean the court was throwing in some dicta?
That I believe that it's true that in Fashion the court was predominantly focused on a hearsay issue, but it still did make a ruling that I think that should have been considered by the military judge given the similarity between the corroborative evidence in Fashion and in the immediate case.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, Your Honor.
Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Captain Hopkins?
Chief Judge Olson, Senior Judge Efron, members of the court, good morning. May it please the court. My name is Captain Andrew Hopkins, along with my co-counsel, Major Pamela Jones. We represent the United States. This court should affirm the conviction because the military judge did not commit prejudicial error when he permitted the government to admit appellant's statements to law enforcement. These statements did not violate Military Rule of Evidence 304 Charlie, and the judge's findings that the statements were sufficiently corroborated was reasonable and therefore well within his discretion. Under the granted issue here, you basically have two questions to answer. What counts as corroboration under Rule 304 Charlie? And having determined that, was it reasonable for the judge to have found appellant's statements to law enforcement in his two recorded interviews with CID corroborated by that standard? So what counts as corroboration under Military Rule of Evidence 304 Charlie? There is no better guide than the language of the rule itself, which was, as you are aware, amended in 2016 to, quote, bring military practice in line with federal practice. In doing so, the drafters eliminated the prior rule's focus on essential facts and replaced it with language reflective of what is known as the trustworthiness doctrine, also known as the OPER standard of the federal rule. In short, the rule now explicitly requires nothing less and nothing more than that the evidence, independent of the confession, raise only an inference of the truth of the confession. The independent evidence in this case certainly raises an inference of the truth of appellant's confessions to having committed lewd acts upon his 18-month-old stepdaughter. As the judge indicated in his ruling, appellant's despicable comments about the spilled milk appearing to him as ejaculate on her face, and that this baby girl who's still in diapers, who's teething a toy carrot, looked to him as though she was, quote, sucking a dick, these comments standing alone were sufficient to corroborate appellant's confession to having touched and penetrated the baby's genitals, reflective as they are of appellant's motive and his intent.
Can I ask a question, Captain Hopkins, based on that? When we're in this type of situation where we're looking at corroboration, are we bound by what the military judge cites as the reasons, or can we as an appellate court look at the entire record and point to additional facts that would cause us to conclude that there was corroboration?
I believe in reviewing the military judge's decision for an abuse of discretion, you can look at the entire record. And in fact, as the judge found as corroborative in this case was the comments that I just mentioned, but this wasn't the only independent evidence that he considered and he relied upon in arriving at his conclusion. There was the independent evidence.
Counsel, before you move on, what is the, despicable as the comments are, what is the nexus between someone making those comments and sexually abusing a child?
In this case, for the corroborating the truthfulness of his confession, these kind of comments are not merely a reflection of poor judgment. They're reflective of a frame of mind of someone who has the capacity to look at an 18-month-old baby who's still in diapers in this sexualized manner. It isn't dispositive of the truthfulness of his statement, but it doesn't have to be. It merely raises an inference of the truth that when he said that he touched her, that he actually did. And that's all that's required under Military Rule of Evidence 304 Charlie. But again, this wasn't the only thing that the judge relied upon whenever he found that this confession was corroborated. He also found the appellant's statements and description of the specific location where he committed these acts, in a room in the house at a time frame when they were at that place, on a specific piece of furniture. This was not just any changing table. This was a sentimental piece of furniture of his wife's that he described in a certain way and that she corroborated. In addition to describing these essential facts of where the offense occurred, there was the concerning and problematic sexual behavior of the child, that she exhibited after these offenses took place. These three things were what the judge considered and what he articulated as being sufficiently corroborative of the trustworthiness of appellant's confession. But to Your Honor's point, these were not the only things that he could have considered. There was, of course, also the text message that the appellant sent to his team sergeant, kind of vague and ambiguous. It's not exactly clear what he's saying in that, but he does certainly at least suggest that he may have inappropriately touched his daughter. And again, this is raising an inference of the truth. This is the standard that's required under the rule. And under case law, an inference of truth has been described as a very slight standard. And Melvin, this is a very slight, very low burden. In addition,
counsel, can you point us to a decision in a federal court, civilian court, that uses the word slight?
In a federal civilian court? I don't have that at hand, Your Honor, but I have four different.
Does that test survive the amendment of Rule 304? If we can't find that in federal civilian practice?
Well, Your Honor, so the language of the rule, the inference of the truth standard, was not what was amended in the rule. So the standard remains the same. It's merely looking at the contents of the confession and what has to be corroborated. And of course, under the old rule, the focus was on these essential facts, and under Adams, the test was, if a fact is corroborated, then that fact is admissible. If a fact in the confession is not corroborated, then that fact is not admissible. However, the new rule excises this reference to the essential facts and specifically and globally allows the confession in where there is sufficient indicia of the facts of the confession.
Are there any express words in 304 that would reject any aspect of Opper or Smith or Wan Sung?
We don't believe so, Your Honor.
Okay, so then in interpreting the rule, we would then look upon the better rule is that from Opper, the corroborative evidence need not be sufficient independent of the statements to establish corpus delicti. It is necessary, therefore, to require the government to introduce substantial independent evidence which would establish the trustworthiness of that statement. Does government have a problem with us considering that language from Opper?
In the particular case, Your Honor, there was substantial evidence of the accused, of the trustworthiness of the accused statement.
And Opper also says it is sufficient if the corroboration supports the essential facts admitted sufficiently to justify a jury inference of their truth. Does the government have a problem with those words in Opper?
No problem whatsoever, Your Honor.
So that the phrase essential facts does have a role to play in our analysis, applying the way it's used in Opper.
Yes, Your Honor, we think that it does.
Thank you.
Essential facts are the tools that are by which this court may determine whether or not the appellant's confession is corroborated by independent evidence. In this case, he alleged in his confession, or he confessed, he described committing a particular crime in a particular manner at a particular place. All of these things are essential facts, and all of which were corroborated by the independent evidence through the testimony of his wife. In addition to what we've described as what the judge considered and the additional fact of the text message that the judge could have considered, it's not for nothing that in this case, when given the opportunity and after recanting, he did recant in his confession to the penetrative offenses, he nevertheless doubled down and reaffirmed that, yes, the incident I described where I spread the daughter's labia and blew in her vagina, yes, that did happen. We would suggest that this is, in itself, an additional piece of evidence that the judge could have considered when arriving at his conclusion that the confession was independently corroborated.
Chief Judge, can I ask a question?
Absolutely, Judge Sparks.
Counsel, just so I understand what actually happened at the trial or happened with respect to these statements. As I understand it, the accused had two interviews and during each interview talked about different things. The first interview he talked about having these urges, and I think the second interview he talked about the actual conduct, the actual acts. Now, with regard to the first interview, and the statements or admissions he made about having these urges. My understanding is that those statements were admitted under Military Rule of Evidence 404B. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So there was no need to corroborate those statements.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And in fact, you can then use those statements to corroborate any admissions or confessions the accused might have made later on.
Yes, Your Honor, that is our position as well. He could have considered those statements made in the first interview as corroborating the confessions in the second.
So along with these other factors you mentioned as well.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
So in sum, what we have here, Your Honor, is overwhelming, substantial evidence of the truthfulness of the confession. Moreover, this particular kind of crime, what the appellant confessed to in this crime, he confessed to touching the labia, spreading the labia, and blowing into the vagina of an 18-month-old girl. This particular crime doesn't leave a mark, doesn't leave a trace, makes it no less of a crime. To interpret this rule in a way that would require that the crime itself had to be corroborated independently would foreclose prosecutions of these types of crimes moving forward. And that's precisely what the amendment to the rule was intended to address. The rule requires nothing more and nothing less to determine whether or not there are good reasons to think that when a person makes a confession, that what they're saying is trustworthy. That evidence is then permitted to be considered by the panel, and they give it the weight they deem appropriate. In this case, when we talked about careful scrutiny being applied to situations where there are indicia of unreliability and the government concedes, there are some indicia of unreliability in some of the things that, for which he confessed in the second statement to CID. He, in fact, recanted the penetrative offenses. But it's certainly possible that this was persuasive to the panel who acquitted him of those charges. So what we're talking about here is merely whether or not a confession made by an accused should get before the finder of fact and let them make the determination and give it the weight they deem appropriate. The standard to get that in front of them is a very low standard. It is very slight. We need merely raise an inference of the truth that when the person is saying that they're doing a certain crime in a certain way, in a certain place, in a certain manner, we have reasons to think that that, in fact, is the case.
In your brief, I don't think you discuss prejudice. Why is that? Are you conceding that if there was a 304 problem here that it is inherently prejudicial?
Yes, Your Honor. I think the case would have to be remanded for a rehearing, specifically because of the nature of this particular type of crime. As I said, this type of crime leaves no mark, leaves no trace. There's no way that it could have been proven up by independent evidence under what has been described as the corpus delicti rule under the old rule.
So here you're saying under these specific facts, you're not saying that when a military judge errs on any 304C issue, that it is always prejudicial.
Precisely, Your Honor. Exactly, because of the nature of this case. Without, if the burden on the government was to establish that the actual touching had happened under the old corpus delicti rule, there would be no way to do that in this case. What you have is the confession of the appellant. That's what establishes that he did that particular act. But we have reasons to believe that when he said that, he was being trustworthy because the context of him providing that confession corroborates the truthfulness of it. Again, he specifically described how he did it. He specifically described where he did it, when he did it. It was in the summer right before they moved from Fort Drum to Germany. He described that it was in a particular bedroom on that particular piece of furniture. It's relevant because, as the wife testified, that particular piece of furniture actually moved around in the house and wasn't in the same room that entire time. But when the accused says, yes, it was in her bedroom at the time that I did this, that's relevant. It's not dispositive of the matter, but it doesn't have to be. It merely needs to raise an inference of the truth. And that's all that was required under the rule, and that's what was met in this case. For this reason, the judge did not abuse his discretion. It was well within the reasonable options for him to allow the panel to consider this information. And for that reason, we ask that you affirm the conviction and the sentence. Thank you, Your Honor.
Any further questions? Thank you. Captain Kiss?
I'd like to start with addressing something that the government just said, that in these types of cases, if they had to prove that there was a touching, that there would be no way that they could satisfy the corroborative rule. That's just clearly not the case in light of a number of cases that this court and its predecessor have addressed. In Yates, you had a circumstance where there was a 2-year-old child with an active chlamydia infection, and that was used as corroboration of sexual abuse. In Cottrell, you actually had a young child, 3 years old, make an outcry saying that her daddy had hurt her. And even in Baldwin, there's a case where the appellant's wife came home and found him in bed with the child, covered the child and himself with a blanket, and then ran out of the room crying and asking to speak with the chaplain. So there's other circumstances, other evidence that can be relied upon here. In our brief, we listed out the fact there could be DNA, there could be injuries, there could be eyewitnesses, there could be outcries. But the one thing that needs to be there is some evidence to show that an actual crime occurred, and we just don't have sufficient evidence of that in the immediate case.
Counsel, to that point, I'd like to ask you the same question that the chief asked the government, which is, are we bound by the explanation that the military judge gave as to which facts he found in the record were established the corroboration, or are we free to look at the entire record and decide for ourselves whether or not we agree that the confession was corroborated?
Your Honor, I believe the case law says that the reviewing courts can consider additional information, but I do think for purposes of determining whether the military judge abused his discretion and whether he deserves any deference, it should be limited to what he considered. And one more thing just to address Judge Efron's question with respect to the term slight. The term slight first appeared in Yauman, which is a 1987 Court of Military Appeals case. And in making that standard, they cited to Opper and 5 federal circuits, and not a single one of them used the word slight. So that's something that's wholly a creation of military jurisprudence. But even when using the term slight, it's not nearly as far-reaching as the government makes it out to be. In Yauman, for example, you had a person who stole a bunch of cassette tapes and then confessed to throwing them out in a dumpster, where he was able to bring the person he confessed to and show them where they were located and prove that it actually happened. In Melvin, which the government cites to where it says very slight, you had an individual who confessed to smoking heroin-laced cigarettes at a party at his friend's house earlier in the evening. And when he was detained, he was found in the possession of heroin-laced cigarettes and other heroin paraphernalia, and they were able to confirm that he had been spending the evening earlier in the day with a compatriot of his who was a known drug dealer. And so that's what was relied upon as very slight. So ultimately, I think the best rule is what this court said in Adams, which is regardless of whether it's slight, very slight, or what the standard is, it just needs to be sufficient, both in quality and in quantity, to satisfy the actual rule that the law puts forth. And that would be the holdings in Smith and in Opper.
Counselor, may I ask just one question? Could you respond to the government's argument just now that the evidence that was admitted under 404 could be used as corroborative evidence for the other statements that were only admitted under 304?
Your Honor, I don't believe that confessions can be used in that way. I think that we said this briefly in a footnote in our brief. But if confessions were able to be admitted under Rule 404B, the entire point of 304 Charlie and the corroborative doctrine wouldn't matter, because any statement would always be admissible as a, you know, consciousness of guilt. And so I think the better way to look at, I believe it's 304 Charlie 3 that talks about if it's admissible under another rule of evidence, then it doesn't need corroboration, would be an analog of the that involuntary statements can be used as impeachment value or for something other than their substance. But I think to read it as expansively as the government argues would completely defeat the purpose of the rule in its entirety.
Judge Sparks, do you have any questions?
I do not. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is now submitted. The court thanks the parties for both sides. The court will stand in recess until 9:30 tomorrow morning.